This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
And you're listening to History Teachers Talking Podcast.
Now part of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
All right, this is Peter Zablocki and Thomas Reska, and welcome back to our podcast. What do we got today, Tommy?
Well, today we're going to be exploring probably one of the major events in world history, definitely in Western history, right? One that I'm kind of surprised we haven't already covered, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the fulcrum of like Western civilization.
A major event, definitely. Everyone's heard of. So today we're going to be looking at the French Revolution, which really was a major event in world history. Starts in 1789, ends in the late 1790s. Really, it ends when Napoleon takes power. We've talked about Napoleon, but we haven't talked about really like how he came to power. We haven't really talked about like the events that led to him coming to power, like a whole different thing. I guess a prequel to that, right? So the French Revolution was really just a period of time when the French citizens just, they altered the political landscape. They uprooted centuries-old institutions like the monarchy and the feudal system. They were really just disgusted with the French aristocrats and the policies, particularly economic policies, of King Louis the 16th. He met his death by the guillotine along with his wife, Marie Antoinette, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Again, everyone's heard of that, right? Yeah. And it started off like this revolution, and then it kind of degenerated into the Reign of Terror, which is a total bloodbath, which we'll talk about. But if you just look at like contextually, like the French Revolution really helped shape modern democracies by showing that like the power was inheritedly with the people, that the people made this decision. And this was like a big thing, especially in, I mean, yes, you had this going on across the Atlantic, obviously already at this point with American colonies, now the United States by this point, but very, very new country, about 10 years old. And really the American Revolution created the French Revolution. There's no way to argue, that connection is there. We'll talk about that a little
bit. And that comes up a lot, yeah.
Yeah, that comes up a lot. But like, it's particularly in Western Europe where you had these like centuries old aristocrats, you know, background and these like the history and stuff.
No, absolutism and all that.
To uproot that was a big deal. A lot of the other kingdoms, the aristocrats that saw what was going on in France, like, we don't want it to happen because they were then worried if it happens in France, it's going to happen in Austria and in Britain. It's going to spread everywhere. And that's what they were afraid of. And that's what ultimately happened also. Not necessarily as bloody. They all wanted to avoid. They saw how bloody the French Revolution got because it lasted for over 10 years, you know, with different ways and flows until Napoleon eventually takes power. But really it's because of the events of the French Revolution that allowed Napoleon to take power.
As the entire thing was born out of the ideas of enlightenment. So the French Revolution itself winds up changing the country's political, social landscape, right? More or less uproots the centuries-old institutions, creates new social orders, and it put into practice the idea that governments are formed, as you said, by the will of the people. Yes. And, you know, this goes on for 10 years, obviously. And at one point, Thomas Jefferson is actually there in France.
Yeah, he's there for a while for it.
Yeah, he winds up like writing a firsthand account of what's happening. And he's not there for the Reign of Terror aspect, which really the Reign of Terror, which whenever I go about teaching the French Revolution, the first thing that my students talk about is the guillotine, right? And like, oh, they were beheading people. In a grand scheme of things, the Reign of Terror really only lasted from September of 1793 to July of 1794. There's a lot more to this, which we'll get into in a little bit. You know, there's a reason why there was a revolution.
It's very different. When you hear revolution, you think, oh, it's like one country for another. This is also, you can also say it's like almost like a French Civil War to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And all these different factions trying to take power. So it's very different from what the American Revolution is just 10 years prior.
Yep. So let's talk about the origins of the French Revolution. I think that's a good way to start. And in 1780s, everyone in France belonged to one of three social classes. These social classes are known as estates. There's the first estate, which is the clergy, the second estate, which is the nobility, and the third estate, which is essentially like the mishmash of everyone from like middle class down to the peasants.
Yeah, everyone who basically was not of royal blood.
Exactly.
For the most part.
Clergy was, I mean, they were like the top boss, right? The first estate. Enormous wealth, privilege. The church owned about 10% of all the land, paid no direct taxes whatsoever, but collected funds.
Well, that's, I think, people. When that was a big point that you just mentioned, Pete, was that they didn't pay any tax. The clergy paid no tax. And the second estate, the aristocrats, also paid no tax. So all the taxes were simply coming from the peasants.
The third estate.
And these sort of things, a lot of them too, were very wealthy. Okay. But like you said, this is everyone from like the wealthy, let's say.
Like a middle class. Just a bourgeoisie. Like your merchant.
Yeah. But everyone down to just like the farmers who were just growing turnips, whatever, you know, to like to feed themselves and their family. So it's all the way down. And they're the only ones paying taxes. This is what's going to cause a lot of problems because as the 18th century, you know, comes to a close, France spent a lot of money on the American Revolution. The American Revolution doesn't happen if it's not for the French money, the French fleet that eventually come over. And they're just doing that really not for the revolution, but just to get back at Britain. So that's why they're doing it. But that is, it bankrupts France. And then plus King Louis the 16th, he's just spending his money on the royal palace. He's just spending money on things that don't need to be spent money on at that moment. And they're on the brink of bankruptcy. Like the royal coffers are severely depleted. Plus there's a poor harvest. There's a drought, cattle disease, and bread prices are high. So the peasants and the poor are like, something's got to change. So there's a lot of looting going on. They're striking, rioting. So these are still getting imposed with these heavy taxes to try to replenish and pay for the American Revolution, basically, plus all this other spending that the king is doing. So all this together is just creating this perfect storm.
And right? also creating a massive gap between a socioeconomic gap between these groups. Yeah. I mean, by as you mentioned, by 1789, half of all the government's income from taxes went to just paying interest on, you know, loans and debt.
Yeah.
So this financial crisis, you know, obviously the only way to fix it as far as the clergy was concerned and as far as the nobility were concerned was to increase taxes. And, you know, let's reduce expenses and increase taxes, except they're not taxing themselves, right? So now you have...
Yeah. These are the wealthiest people, the wealthiest ones.
The third estate, where even like the smallest rise in bread, price of bread, their main food, right, would bring like threat of hunger or starvation. Like in 1775, before the French Revolution, you already had peasant revolts. The one of the main ones was the Flour War. I don't know if you remember that. It was essentially a high price of bread caused, you know, the people to revolt. They could not afford food. And the bourgeoisie, which was the, as we mentioned before, the merchants, like the upper echelon of the third estate, they had money more or less. However, bulk of that third estate was the peasants, just peasants.
People that own nothing. And again, these are only ones paying taxes. So Louis XVI, actually his followers, one of his, you know, his controller general, but is a man by the name of Charles Alexander de Colon, actually proposed a financial reform package. And that said in this, he's going to have a universal land tax. And the aristocratic class was not going to be exempt from it anymore. So the aristocrats were going to have to pay. These are wealthy landowners, basically. All right, you're going to have to pay now your fair share of taxes. It's going to be universal. And he says, if we do this, we're going to be able to pay off our debt. Yeah. And of course, they're saying they don't want to like change. Like, why do we suddenly have to pay? We never had to pay before. Now we have to pay. That doesn't make any sense. So that's going to give rise to
the estates general.
King's going to be calling the estates general, which is the first time it's called since 1614.
175 years it has not been called yet.
And France has changed a lot in 175 years. So he brings together the schedule for May 5th, 1789, and it's basically where all the classes could basically come together and they were allowed to basically make a list of grievances that lay before the king, right?
Yep.
And that's what he wants. He's trying to gain support for this universal tax because he supports it because it's going to fix things fine, whatever. He's still not paying it. He's the king, right? Whatever. What happens, though, is that the third estate is so much larger now than what it previously was.
Yeah, they want to be counted by a head as opposed to one vote.
Well, because they realize that they'll always be outvoted because the clergy and the nobles can just outvote them 2-1 no matter what. And they say, no, we account for 98% of the population. We have to be counted by head. And this is, again, the will of the people. And then they're starting to gain support. So this is where everything's coming together. King Louis calls the state general to basically try to get this tax put in place. But it winds up, it doesn't even get to that. Like, there's so many other things going on because this third estate quickly realizes that this tax can never get put in place because no one's going to vote to tax themselves. And we're always going to be outvoted 2-1, 2-1, 2-1, no matter what.
Well, and that's what happens. After weeks of the stalemate, the delegates of the third estate basically take this daring step. They basically claiming that they are the true representatives of France and the French people. They declare themselves to be the National Assembly.
And something called the Tennis Court Oath.
Because they literally, that's what happens. Because
they get
what happens
kicked
is
out, they leave.
They get kicked out of the actual assembly. So they're this new National Assembly, they can't no longer meet with the other groups. So because they were fearing that the king was going to dismiss them, they basically, all the delegates moved to a nearby indoor tennis court. And everyone's kind of like, speculators are looking on like, what the heck is happening there, right? And the delegates took their famous tennis court oath, right? They swore never to separate and to meet wherever the circumstances might require until we have established a sound and just constitution.
Yeah, they wanted constitutional reform. And they start to get support.
Well, the clergy comes up, right?
Most of the clergy and some nobles, liberal nobles, actually join them. So on June 27th, King Louis actually has to absorb all three orders into one new National Assembly. So they basically get what they want as far as now they're going to have, it's almost like one man, one vote now, right?
Yep.
These are all got absorbed into one. This isn't going to stop any of the
uprisings on a street. Yeah. No.
They're saying this is good, but it's not what we throw on. We need actual reform.
Talking about a reform and actual reforming are two different things, right?
Because they still don't trust the king.
You would think that this is like a good move, but the spotlight is very much taken from this event, the new National Assembly meeting in Versailles, because of what's happening in the Bastille.
So like the tennis court, oh, it's going on one place. They're trying to get their representation. We're on another part of France. Yeah, you have Bastille Day, which is when rioters stormed the Bastille Fortress in an attempt to secure gunpowder, weapons. And this is kind of what's considered by a lot of people the start of the French Revolution. Yeah. And it's actually a national holiday, Bastille Day, in France today.
To this day, yeah. Well, for the French, the Bastille was a powerful symbol of tyranny, right? And inequalities, injustices of the old order. Yeah.
Political prison.
Yeah, basically storming this political prison signaled the end of absolute monarchy. Like it was a step towards freedom because the political prisoners in there were unjustly held by the absolute monarch. So again, to this day, it's kind of viewed as July 14th is a national holiday when the French celebrate the birth of modern France. You know, the revolts continue. It's not just this National Assembly's talk about how they're going to make everything equal, but things are not equal yet. So there's a massive political crisis in 1789 that coincides with the worst famine, basically, at the time. So not only is there a political crisis, but there's also a massive famine. And the starving peasants wound up roaming the countryside and flocking to towns where they start swelling up in ranks. So now you have a lot of disgruntled people in cities and towns. The grain prices in 1789 soared. Even people with jobs had to spend as much as 80% of their income just on bread.
Just on bread, just to feed their families for that week or month, whatever, yeah.
You know, and now you have this, you know, they're inflamed by famine and fear. These peasants can like unleash their fury on the nobles. Like it's the nobles. They're trying to reimpose medieval dues and they're not fixing our situations. We always pay taxes. Yeah, they're going to want to maybe pay taxes, but that still doesn't help us because we're still going to have to pay them. Paris and a lot of major cities are breaking into riots. I mean, there's no better way to put that.
That's what's happening, yeah.
So the National Assembly on August 4th is like an all-night meeting, and the nobles in the National Assembly basically voted to end their own privileges. But this is fake, and I'll get into that in a second. So they agreed, because there's so much unrest, the nobles agree that they're going to give up dues, right? They're going to no longer have exclusive hunting rights. They're going to give up their special legal status, and they're going to give up their exemption from taxes. But in a grand scheme of things, a lot of like contemporary people and modern historians see that the nobles basically gave up nothing that they had not already lost.
It was supposed to be called the death certificate of an old order, of the old order. That's kind of what it was called. But it really didn't happen yet because they kind of lost a lot of those things anyway previously, or weren't exactly using them either. It was kind of something, we just tell them, like it was more for show to appease the peasants, but they didn't really, I guess the peasants didn't really fall for it, would be the best way. Yeah. They wanted actual proof. Again, they want to see proof. You have to understand too what's going on with the French people, because they just spent years helping the Americans win independence, right? Get away from a monarchy, get away from tyranny, whatever you want to call it. And now here they are in their own homeland. We don't have it. We were still experiencing these things. How does that make sense? So that's part of this too, like logically, philosophy-wise.
And this is when the National Assembly takes the steps towards the first constitution. So the very first step really towards a constitution, very similar to how in the United States, you have the Declaration of Independence as the main document that starts it, and eventually that somehow spirals to the Articles of Confederation and therefore to the Constitution. Here you have the Assembly issues a Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, basically very much modeled on the American Declaration of Independence. All men in the French Declaration announced were born and remained free and equal in rights. And then it gets into like enjoying natural rights of liberty, property, security, resistance to oppression. Very, you know, they borrowed a lot from Locke as well.
Yeah, Rousseau, the Enlightenment. Like this is a basis right out of that time period.
Yep.
Right out of that time period.
But the issue is that even though they're saying all this, initially Louis XVI does not want to accept any of these reforms because that means giving up his absolute power. The nobles, though, even though there's so much unrest, still continue to enjoy their gala banquets, and people are starving and they're still being nobles.
Yeah, they're still living their life. Yeah, they're still throwing those parties, right? You have that fame. I don't know if it happens right now or a little later on, right? With Marie Antoinette, the whole let them eat cake, which she probably never said.
Yeah,
not she probably. She didn't say that.
Yep.
It wouldn't even make sense. But it just shows that how people viewed her, right? That's she was Austrian also, right? That's why they didn't like her.
She was.
So that's the whole, we should do one just on her one day.
Honestly. But, even here, like in autumn, right? You had the October 5th, 6,000 women marched like 13 miles in a pouring rain from Paris to Versailles. They're screaming, "Bread, you know, give us bread." They demanded to see the king. And that's where the supposedly the story goes that, you know, Antoinette was like, "Yeah, I don't care that they marched here for 13 miles. Like, I'm not giving them bread."
You got to understand, these are all these aristocrats. They didn't know what like starvation was. Starvation, yeah. Hunger, you know, working hard, trying to survive. They live lives of privilege. So to suddenly hear these other people complain, they're like, "Well, why are you complaining? What do you mean?" You know, they were always brought up. They were always, you know, thinking that how they were basically, you know, selected by God, right? And of noble birth and stuff like that. To see other people now questioning them, especially peasants questioning them, it was just something they could not fathom.
Well, it gets so bad, though, after this event that Louis and his family winds up moving, right, to a different house. For like 3 years, well, they eventually try to escape the country, but before they do that, they wound up moving to a smaller palace. Like for 3 years, Louis was more or less like a virtual prisoner.
If they went anywhere, people were going to kill him. Yeah. You had people that were still loyal. Because that was also what was going on after this Declaration of Rights of Man. There was a lot of these questions going on, like who was going to be responsible for electing delegates, the clergy, was they going to be alliance of Roman Catholic Church or the French government? But really the big thing was like, how much authority would the king have? Was he just a public image? Those are questions too that were out there that had to be answered, because there were people that said, "Yeah, just kill the guy, you know, just whatever." He'd be like, just limit the power of the king. He can still be a branch of government, a figurehead to rally people together, you know?
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.
Well, that's kind of where you get the National Assembly starts their real big reforms here, right? So, as you alluded to before, controlling the church was step one. To pay off the huge government debt, right? Much of it owned to the bourgeoisie, actually. The assembly votes to take over and sell church lands, which obviously upsets a lot of the clergy. But that's kind of the thing. It's like under the civil constitution, they created a new constitution. It's the constitution of 1791. The church is now under state control, right? This constitution of 1791, based in part on the U.S. Constitution, it more or less curtails royal power. And it's also prefaced by the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which you mentioned before. But just kind of to summarize it, it gave citizens the right to hold jobs based on talent, as opposed to like, I know you, or I know somebody. Supposedly, again, this is all supposedly happening. Gave citizens the right to move about freely, gave tax-paying males the right to elect or choose their own ministers, allowed the citizens to gather peacefully, taxed citizens equally, that was key, and then prohibited the government, so really the king, from making laws curtailing civil and natural rights. That was big. People could now publish, write ideas without fear of government censorship, so on and so forth.
But the king then had veto power over anything and the ability to appoint ministers. And that kind of compromise that didn't sit well with a lot of radicals, basically. In particular, Maximilien de Robespierre. He really didn't like that. And him and his followers start drumming up popular support for a more republican form of government and actually to put King Louis on trial. Yep. So this is what's going to lead into the French Revolution turning a bit more radical as time progresses, because they're saying, all right, they did some reforms, but ultimately the king still has veto power. He can still put the nobles wherever he wants. They're going to be appointed. This one's, you know, you're appointed over taxation. You're appointed over the lands. You know, so he still has a lot more power than they feel like he should have. Plus, they don't want the monarchy there at all. A lot of the more radical.
Well, and the monarchy gets it, because what winds up happening is in June of 1791, Louis and Marie Antoinette, basically, it's a very humiliating situation because they try to escape. So the king is disguised as a servant. The queen dressed as a governess, and the attempt to escape failed because in a town along the way, Louis' disguise was uncovered by someone who held up a piece of currency, which is kind of crazy, with the king's face on it, right? So they like put up and they're like, that's you. So they wind up basically like escorting him back to their Paris, their palace. And they're like, yeah, you're not going anywhere. But at that point, you already had onlooking crowds were like hurling insults at them. Like, you know, instead of long live the king, they're like, you know, they're like, long live the nation, not you.
Yeah, they lost a lot of their prestige. That was gone. And then this new elected assembly in 1792 declares war on Austria and Prussia. And because they believe that the individuals there were, you know, playing counter-revolutionary alliances. But the real reason was they wanted to try to spread the revolutionary ideas across Europe through warfare. That was their idea. We can spread and get rid of all these monarchies this is when, at least in France itself, is when the crisis took a more radical turn.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the idea here is that a lot of these neighboring countries were so freaked out by what was happening in France that it started almost like banning French people from moving across the border. Because there was a massive exodus of nobles and clergy that were trying to just like move over to Prussia and other areas. And these European countries are like, no. So basically, like you said, to almost like as of like, how dare you do that? But also to spread revolution. April 1792, the War of Words between French revolutionaries and European monarchs basically turn into actual war.
It comes bloody, yeah.
Yeah, first Austria, then Prussia, then Britain, and then other states. And initially, the great powers, all those great powers, thought they were going to win really easily against France because they're like, well, France is divided by a revolution. But the fighting that began in 1792 did not really end until like 1815.
Yeah, there's all these smaller wars. Yeah, even during Napoleon was there. Yep. Napoleon, a lot of these French Revolutionary Wars became like parts of Napoleonic Wars. Yep. But the big thing that also happens in 1792 in this time is you have the extremist Jacobins. They actually attack the royal residence in Paris, and they arrest the king on August 10th, 1792.
Well, we have to see these guys as like, these guys are part of the Legislative Assembly, but they're very hostile factions, right? They're very radical. Extremists. Most of them were middle-class lawyers, very intellectual, smart people. You know, a lot of them were newspaper editors. The idea is that, like, these guys were just very extreme. Like, all right, enough is enough. Like, we're either doing this or we're not doing this.
They say it's time to rip the Band-Aid off. Like, that's it. Those compromises, early constitutions, those are just Band-Aids. We either rip it off or make something new. And the following month, there was a whole bunch of violence between these insurrectionists. A lot of the counter-revolutionaries were killed. Hundreds of them were killed, accused ones. Yep. The Legislative Assembly was then replaced by the National Convention. Okay, so kind of gonna get this stuff all like evened out. And they proclaimed the abolition of the monarchy and the establishment of the French Republic. So they're saying there's no monarchy at all now in France. They're done. Bye. And here we go to the National Convention.
It's going to do the suffrage. It basically expands their right to all male citizens to vote, not just property owners. Yep.
They're going to be Republic now. Leads to January 1793, where King Louis is put on trial and condemned to death for high treason. And he went to the guillotine. And his
wife, was interesting too. He was convicted by a single vote.
Like, yeah, there was still a lot of people that were just like, well, he's the king. He was kind of just doing his job or doing what he was believes he wanted to do. But too many other people were saying he's just too dangerous to have alive. Like to have the king alive is dangerous.
It was a gruesome thing. I mean, we know a lot about what happened that day. Obviously, it wasn't super. I mean, it was long ago. But in January of 1793, so it's called, Louis mounts the scaffold, rather, in public square in Paris. And he starts talking. And we know what he said until it got too loud. But initially, he started with, "Frenchmen, I die innocent. I pardon the authors of my death. I pray God that the blood about to be split will never fall upon the head of France, blah, 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 because..." Then you had like a roll of drums that basically drowned out his words. So we don't actually know what his last words were. And then after that, you know, they beheaded him. And then the executioner lifted the king's head by the hair and held it out before the crowd. And everyone was like roaring. Like,
think about this. This is like just a few years prior. He's the most powerful person in France. He said his face is on money.
Yeah.
And now people are cheering his head. And a lot of it was because of him, or like we said, his lifestyle, whatever. But it's also just it signifies the true end of the monarchy. And then there's a lot of debate what's going to happen with his wife, but 9 months later, they also behead her.
The son that might have become Louis the 17th died of like unknown causes, right? Dungeons. I think he was in a dungeon.
They didn't kill him as he was so young, but they think he was just kind of like malnourished and kind of just forgotten about with everything else going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But what was going on in the Reign of Terror? Like, oh yeah, that kid's still alive over there. You know what I mean?
Well, this is where it gets interesting, right? Because you just alluded to this Reign of Terror. This is not even considered Reign of Terror yet.
Basically, not yet.
Yeah,
that's
like this is, you already have, you have the September massacres, right? Thousands of prisoners are killed, including many criminals and other people, political people that supposedly committed political offenses. And then the king is beheaded, the queen is beheaded. But now, like, you're like, oh my God, this is so bloody. Only now does the true Reign of Terror start. And it starts with a new 12-member committee that basically has absolute power, right? Committee of Public Safety. Because there's so many supposed threats to France, the convention creates this committee, selects 12 people, and they're like, all right, we're going to call this the Committee of Public Safety. And basically, they're going to keep France safe from anyone.
From all these, anyone who's going against the French Republic.
Exactly. Inside or outside. This is, you know, whether you live or not. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what starts to happen. It's basically a 10-month period where anyone who is like suspected to be an enemy of the revolution, They were guillotined by the thousands, right?
Well, this is Robespierre. Robespierre's the main guy behind this.
Yeah,
right?
He's the main guy. Yeah, he's the main guy, and he carried out a lot of these killings were carried out just on his orders.
Yeah.
And I guess we can get into a little bit, but then he actually gets executed.
Well, yeah, Robespierre,
eventually. He himself during the Reign of Terror. Actually, his death is kind of like the end of the Reign of Terror. There are about like 17,000 people were officially tried and executed during the Reign of Terror, but there's no official number because they don't know how many other people died in prison or just killed because of Robespierre without a trial at all.
Yeah, and there was like 300,000 citizens that were arrested. As you said, 17,000 were definitely executed, we think. It might have been more. But these included nobles, clergy, peasants, and there was really no one that was... We're not discriminating here, you know what I mean?
No, it was anybody, It was almost like the Salem witch trials. Like, you just called someone, they're against the revolution, we obviously had to put them to death. So you called someone a witch, or we got to stone them. It was the same idea. It was a way to get political enemies out of the way.
Mistaken identity, falsely accused people. It doesn't matter. Neighbors would be like, "Oh, my neighbor is kind of iffy." Boom, no neighbor.
He still has a picture of the king in his house. What? Oh no, you know.
I said boom, but I'm not, because I don't really know what a sound of a guillotine would make. Like what?
Well, I heard the rumors that the guillotine eventually, some of not all of them, it was obviously more than one. They became very rusty. From like the human, like the iron and stuff in the human blood.
So you needed like a few times.
It wasn't just like a clean cut. It was almost became more like an axe, like a chopping. And they were have to pull it back out. It would get stuck and then let it go and pull it. And it would take a few times to get through the neck. They just got dulled over time.
Well, so it got dulled over time, almost like I said, 10 months and thousands of killings. So weary of the bloodshed, right? And basically fearing for their lives, the members of the convention itself turned against the Committee on Public Safety. And all those guys, including Robespierre, right? They were all arrested in July of 1794. And all their heads are kind of put out like, hey, here you go. Those are the radicals. But now we're not radical anymore. And that more or less ends the Reign of Terror.
Yeah, then it becomes known as the Thermidorian reaction is what it's kind of known as.
It's like a third stage, right? It's a third stage of the
Reign. It's a third stage. And kind of as a, like, they kind of realize when I say they just like, these people in charge or the powers that be are like, the Reign of Terror had a bit too much excess, so let's pull back, right?
And
so
yet another constitution, third constitution now, actually.
So they're just, if you don't have
rights,
change
these laws. These don't work.
So on August 22nd, 1795, the National Convention that, people who survived the Reign of Terror propose a new constitution that created France's first bicameral legislature.
Yeah.
This one had like executive power in the hands of a 5-member directory. Appointed by Parliament, you have Royalists, you have Jacobins, also protested this new regime, but it was swiftly silenced by the army, led by a very young and upcoming general named Napoleon Bonaparte.
Yeah, that pretty much brings us to the beginning of the end here, right?
Yeah, because as Napoleon's rise, the Directory was only in power for 4 years.
Yep,
and then he still had financial crisis. That's the whole point. This whole financial crisis never gets fixed during this time.
There's obviously a lot of negative, but there's also a lot of positive that came out of the French Revolution. There's no question about that. It drastically changed France, right? It dislodged the entire old social order, completely overthrew the monarchy, brought the church under state control. Like, these are massive changes, but also a lot of nationalism. People forget that, France was at war during this whole time. So because the war basically gave the French people a strong sense of like identity, it's us versus them. And as opposed to be feeling like loyal to the king or the authorities, they kind of, were loyal to the sons and daughters of the revolution. Like, we are French. We're the French people. We're doing it for the French land. So you have this pride and devotion to one's country, which also helps Napoleon because he kind of feeds off of that. I am their true representative of France.
And people really backed the army, the military at this point, because that was really what was keeping order in a lot of the cities, was the fact that the military was there. So they're kind of seeing them in these generals who get pretty popular because they're really keeping the public safety at this point.
So basically from 1799 to 1815, Napoleon Bonaparte dominates France and Europe. I mean, it's not just France, it's France and Europe. He was a hero to some, evil to others. But basically the final phrase of the French Revolution basically might as well be called the Age of Napoleon.
Yeah, but he takes power, and like I said, he's going to dominate continental Europe. Then when he finally dies, which check out our podcast about Napoleon and the death of Napoleon, is when France is going to truly become a democracy, republic, lay the groundwork for what it really is today. But none of that happens without the French Revolution before. So you kind of think the French Revolution is an interesting study of like how quickly things can get out of hand with the Reign of Terror, then how quickly that you almost replacing one monarchy with another one. You're replacing a monarchy with an emperor. With a dictator and emperor, Napoleon.
Yeah. And even, I mean, he winds up, once he gets in there, he consolidates his power, right? He strengthens the central government. But his big things were order, security, and efficiency, which were direct answers to the Reign of Terror and what preceded it. You know, now we need order. Now we need to feel secure and we need to be efficient. So it wasn't like liberty, equality, fraternity. Like this was, no, we need to be secure, efficient, like economically, but also feel safe. He sets up a system of public schools under strict government control. Restores economic prosperity. He makes peace with the Catholic Church. And more or less, his economic reforms and restoration of order after all the years of chaos basically opened jobs that were based on talent.
He was giving them what they wanted to begin with. Yeah, that's one reason why he's able to rise to power. But, you know, he gets a little bit too power hungry, obviously.
Yes.
So, but things.
That's
another podcast I had to go listen to. And during this time, too, I guess we forgot to mention, like, the United States, like, George Washington says, we are not bound by treaty to interfere in this war. He's saying Thomas Jefferson, he actually favored revolutionary France and pointed to a 1778 treaty. And he said, you know, we have to go help the French. And he's like, no, our treaty was with the monarchy, was with King Louis. Yeah. This treaty, these Jacobins or whatever you want, National Assembly, that's not the ones that we made the treaty with, so we're not bound. And he declares neutrality. And then under John Adams, we basically have an undeclared naval war. I guess we can talk about that one, the quasi-war, right?
With France. The United States is like that, like a buzzing mosquito or like a bee during all this, because France is going through so much stuff going on here. They're at war. I mean, eventually they settle with Prussia and all that, but they continue to stay at war with Britain. And, you know, they're fighting these wars. They're going through revolutions. You have Napoleon rising. And through all of this, there's the pesky United States, you know, like, you know, quasi-war with France. They're going to take our sailors or stop our ships. Britain's doing the same thing, but hey, we're just going to go after France. So we're going to start attacking French ships. You know, even Britain gets a brunt of this mosquito because we have to... War of 1812, which you could also go back and listen to a podcast. And now Britain's like, dude, we're trying to deal with France ourselves. Like, America's just kind of like buzzing. Bzzz, like, ooh, we're here.
Yeah, with New Nature just trying to get involved here. And we're going to take advantage of the situation, right? When Napoleon needs money, what do? Hey, we get the Louisiana Purchase.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So, like, so we're kind of like taking advantage of certain situations also. So, you know, not a major play in the world, but aware of what's going on in, you know, playing both sides, I guess you can say. But it was a polarizing issue in the United States. A lot of people said, we have to go support revolutionaries, right? They supported us, we're supporting them. And other people say, no, this is their thing. We're staying out of it.
Well, also because it turned so bloody. Like, yeah, revolution, and all of a sudden it was like...
That's really, from what I saw too, that's really what turned the tide from support against it, was that how quickly it became so bloody. Once you got that Reign of Terror, they're like, yeah, never mind.
Yeah, never mind. Sorry.
Like, we're not getting involved. So.
Craziness. Well, this is basically a crash course in French Revolution. I mean, we did this in 30 minutes. There is
very basic, very
so
quick,
much more to
yeah,
this.
There are courses just on that, rightfully so, books, documentaries. Yeah. I mean, the amount of information on endless. We're just giving you a very basic idea of some of the causes, some of the major events, and then the outcomes. But you can see how one leads to the next and next. This is a great example of really when you look at dominoes falling. And one thing affects or cause and effect. You can trace it all the way up to, you know, like I said, the American Revolution. You can trace that back to the French Indian War, right? All these things eventually lead to what happens in the French Revolution, the rise of Napoleon, and eventually the rise of the true French Republic.
Yeah. Yeah. That pretty much covers it.
I think so. I know what I'm talking about, man.
Thank you so much, guys, for tuning in once more. We do appreciate it. If you need to find us, you can find us at www.historyteacherstalkingpodcast.com. We are here to answer any of your questions, and we welcome any comments. Make sure you guys follow us on all the social media, different social media accounts, because we are there. And I guess that's it. We'll see you guys next week.
Stay safe, everybody.
I hope everyone enjoyed our podcast, and if you would like to email us, you can do so at historyteacherspodcast@gmail.com.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because The news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5-Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.